Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
This is All of It on WNYC. I'm Allison Stewart. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. This is our producer picks episode of All of It. We've been doing this all summer, and I thought I'd get in on the action and have my own hour of, well, host picks. So I've picked three different interviews that we've done over the course of the year that I think kind of show us what the show is about and have an interesting story to them. The first is my conversation with Brené Brown. So when you're interviewing someone as famous as Brené Brown, you want to try to have a unique conversation. They get interviewed a lot, and they get asked a lot of the same questions. And I was racking my brain trying to figure out how to interview someone like her. Of course, she's going to be a good interview. Her TED Talk has been viewed a zillion times, and she's been on every kind of talk show. And she was here to promote a Netflix special. So as I was thinking about it, and I crafted all these questions, she came into the room with this great, big, bright energy, and she told me she was obsessed with MTV. From the minute she hit the door of the studio, she just wanted to talk about MTV and Headbangers Ball and rock and roll, right up until the time that the microphones opened. It was so funny, and it was just this really interesting icebreaker. And as you'll hear at the top of this interview, she wanted to continue to talk about music, television, and rock and roll and Headbangers Ball. I knew at that moment that Brené Brown and I were going to have a really fun, unique, spontaneous conversation. So here it is, my conversation with Brené Brown. So you spent all these years researching, writing about shame, vulnerability, courage. What did you want to do when you were a little kid? No little kid thinks that up.
No. And okay, so I have to just full disclosure for the audience. I'm in like fangirl mode because I was like, oh my God, it's you from MTV. I think I wanted to be a cruise director because, you know, representation matters. So all I saw was Julie on the Love Boat.
Uh-huh. Sure.
And then a Dallas Cowgirl cheerleader who, you know, married a quarterback because I'm a fifth generation Texan and that's like the goal. And then for a long time, I wanted to be a VJ on Headbangers Ball.
And the truth is, did not rehearse this question.
No.
That is my first question I wrote yesterday afternoon. I thought, what did Brené Brown want to be when she grew up?
I really wanted to be a VJ on Headbangers Ball. In fact, when I resigned from my first kind of corporate gig to go back to school, my boss said, let me guess, you're either going to be a social worker or you're leaving to become a VJ on Headbangers Ball. And I said, oh, can you hook me up with the people at MTV?
You would have been great.
I would have.
You would have fit right in because it was a place for people who felt the feels and were creative.
And on the outside.
Yeah, it was really an outsider's paradise. It's interesting. The guys who wrote the book about the history of MTV called it the success story of the outsider, the little lower to middle income class folks, gay people, people of color, because it was this new creative place and there weren't any sort of infrastructure in place that kept those people out. Which made it cool.
I mean, it was really, it was serious for me because it was like, until my dad took it away. Mm-hmm. He walked in one time when Duran Duran Hungry Like the Wolf video was on. And, you know, the women are kind of slithering through the jungle.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, and they're painted. Yeah. And he's like, what the hell? but it was for me like there is a world bigger than this, full of people on the outside who are creating and doing amazing things. Like I just – it was a portal.
Oh, I love hearing that.
Yeah.
I love hearing that because I always say to my people, when they come and say stuff like to me, they all are doing amazing things. They're like, oh, I used to watch you. I say, what do you do now? She's like, I'm chief of staff for Senator so-and-so.
Yeah. Yeah. And like now when I listen to the radio and some of the old VJs are like on Sirius or something, I'm like, oh, I hear you. I see you, Nina Blackwood.
What brought you into research? Social work, deciding that these were the areas that you thought, you know what, I can do something here. I can make a difference.
Well, you know, it's not as far. It's not really that far removed from the MTV experience, because I think as an outsider my whole life, I became very good at pattern finding. Like it was very important for me to be able to understand how people's thinking was related to their emotions and their behavior. Mm-hmm. And the more I could understand that, you know, when you're sitting by yourself at lunch, you know, like you can,
oh yes,
you're trying to see like, what is this group of people that everyone just really love? What do they have in common? And these people that are over here with me, what do we have in common? And, you know, and so I was always really good at pattern finding. And so I think research, when I kind of got introduced to research, it made so much sense. So I became a qualitative researcher. And I, you know, I have a bachelor's, master's, and PhD in social work. And I think that's $125,000 in student loans to learn a very important two lessons: social justice and equity matter, and connection is why we're here. And so I think I started my research trying to understand, what is the anatomy of connection? What does that mean? Mm-hmm. And then that led to shame, which is the thing that unravels connection more than anything else, vulnerability, which is the path to connection, and empathy. And so it kind of just all unfolded as I tried to understand, you know, these 3 degrees all this time. And what I can tell you for sure is we're neurobiologically hardwired to be in connection with each other. And in the absence of connection, there's always suffering.
When did you realize that you could take all of this research and this academic lens you were looking through, and you could bring it out of academia and into the real world?
It was a mandate very early on, because in the shame research, which was probably started 20 years ago, the first kind of first big research I did was mm-hmm. around shame. It was the first time I'd ever done a study where, when I was sitting across from people interviewing them, they would look at me and always ask the same question at the end of the interview. When you understand this better and you find out how this works, you're going to come back and tell me, right? You're going to help me, right? Hmm. And the answer was, no, I'm going to publish this in an article that you'll never have access to or read in order to, like, keep my job. And
I don't think that sat that well with you.
No,
I can't imagine you
didn't.
Being okay with that.
It didn't, because here were people telling me about the most excruciating, painful moments of their lives mm-hmm. and the most joyful too. And I was like, this information has to be democratized in a meaningful way.
So you mentioned shame. So your first book was self-published. It was Women and Shame.
Yeah.
And now can be called Thought It Was Just Me, But It Isn't, Making the Journey from What Will People Think to Am I Enough?
Yes.
The self-publishing. Why did that happen? Was that just...
Oh, my God, because I could wallpaper this whole WNYC office in rejection letters. People wrote things that said, as interesting as a book about shame sounds, we're out. The only person that was interested, and this was trying to find an agent, because the publishing houses wouldn't even look at it if it wasn't agented, right? So the agents were like, no way. The publishing houses were like, find an agent, P.S., no way. Except for one publisher who said, we're interested if you're willing to call it Women's Most Embarrassing Moments. Yes.
Next.
I was so pissed.
Next.
I was just like, that's mm-hmm. not what this is painful. This
right.
is real. This is the thing that stalks all of us, including you, dude. And like, this is not going to be Women's Most Embarrassing Moments. So I self-published it. And that was really hard, because back then you didn't have all the self-publishing platforms. So I borrowed money. I just finished graduate school. My husband was still in residency. We were still like looking for couch coins for tacos,
sure.
you know, for dinner. And so I borrowed some money from my parents. I self-published it, took a huge hit with my colleagues. I'd written an academic article in the literature, a peer-reviewed mm-hmm. article. But when I self-published the book, I remember getting on the elevator one day and one of my colleagues said, hey, read your shame book. It's really good. I'm going to put it on my syllabus as required reading. And I was so honored and thrilled. And then like 2 weeks later in a faculty meeting, he came up and said, you vanity published that? I can't ask people to read something like that. And my thinking was like, it's the same content.
Mm-hmm.
But I was in my own shame spiral about my self-published shame book. Then when
you like, sir, you just made my point.
Yeah. This is
by saying that
you're page 42. Then Penguin Random House, the book, self-published book, did really well. And then Penguin Random House came and said, we'd like to publish it. And I walked into a faculty meeting a month after I signed that contract, and the same guy said, hey, it was really cool how you did kind of the indie thing. It was like when they did El Mariachi on that credit card. I was like, too late.
I see you.
You're dead to me. Like, yeah.
My guest is Dr. Brené Brown. She has a new Netflix special called The Call to Courage. I'm working my way up to it. Don't worry. I'm interested in, we're in such an interesting moment about shame. Because we hear about it in so many different ways. We people body shame and they
For sure.
parenting shame. Mm-hmm. On the other side is there are some politicians I wish had more shame. I think people think like, oh, it's so shameless the way they do something. First, are we using shameless the wrong way?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
What are we really trying to say when we say that politician is shamelessly exploiting X, Y, and Z, or shamelessly ignoring X, Y, and Z?
So what we know about shame is that it is not a driver of moral or ethical behavior. So shame actually corrodes the part of us that believes that we can be better and do better. And so when people say, God, no shame, shameless, what they're actually saying is they're actually talking about the emotion that can barely coexist with shame, which is empathy. But we just don't have any good slogans for that, like you empathy-less, you know, so and so.
Let's work on that together.
Yeah, well, we can build something. We can make something, and then like it'll trend. But what we're really talking about is a lack of empathy, because shame, you know, shame is highly correlated with addiction, depression, eating disorders, bullying, violence. I think some of the politicians that you're talking about, at least the ones I'm picturing and thinking of, are not shameless. They're full of it. Mm-hmm. The other mistake we make that I think is interesting is we talk a lot about the same politicians and people we know and sometimes ourselves, unfortunately, as being very narcissistic. It's a word we use a lot today. People think that narcissism is grandiosity, like this huge overinflated ego. But of all of the kind of personality disorders, nothing is more underpinned by shame than narcissism. So I define narcissism as the shame-based fear of being ordinary. And this is for people who need to be, you know, this is the blustering, posturing, bigger than. If you felt good about who you are, you don't need to do that. And so what I think we're really missing is empathy.
So what is it that is causing people in this day and time to feel so free to shame others? It just seems like it is open season.
Yeah, it's blood sport. Shame is blood sport. And here's why. It feels so good. Because it is a weapon of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. And when someone does something really awful, it feels good to discharge our emotion by shaming them. Because it's kind of the cruelest thing you can do. Mm-hmm. You're not attacking someone's behavior. You're attacking who they are. The problem is that shame not only changes the people who are targeted by it, it changes us when we use it against people. I talk about this a lot as an activist, that shame is a tool of oppression. And I will never participate in any effort where shame is trying to be used as a social justice tool. It's just not. Like if you think about Me Too and you think about how shame, humiliation, belittling is used to keep survivors quiet. You can't turn around and use that same deadly tool against perpetrators. You know, and here's the other
thing. As much as you might want to.
Oh, no. Right? Oh, yeah. I'm going to lay in bed and dream about it and think about it and practice it even maybe out loud, but I'm not going to do it because it feels good. It's an instant discharging of emotion. It totally fills up every need we have for self-righteousness, but it's not accountability. Mm-hmm. You really want to make a change? Hold that person accountable, which is takes much longer. It's not as much fun. It doesn't feel as great. It doesn't give you the rush of like, conquered, you know, but it's what changes things.
If someone's listening to this and they're going to go watch the special and they think, what can I do to take those first few steps towards being more authentic, towards taking off the armor, towards being courageous in my life? Just something simple that someone could do?
The simplest thing is, what is my go-to armor?
Identify it.
Identify it and name it. Like, what do I do when things get uncomfortable? Do I please? Do I prove? Do I perfect? Mm-hmm. Do I hide? Do I get aggressive? And, you know, what do I do? And how do I think it's serving me? And is it really serving me? Those are the three questions. I mean, those three questions can change everything for someone. I mean, I believe that, like, really, as a researcher, mm-hmm. if you can understand, here's my armor, here's how I think it's protecting me, and here's how it's really not serving me, that's the beginning of huge change.
And you might need to ask a friend for the last one.
You could ask someone that really knows you and that you trust, mm-hmm. all three of them.
My last question for you is, I'm sure people are super overfamiliar with you. You're everybody's friend, or they've had a really deep personal experience reading your books or listening to you. But, you know, you were off having a barbecue with Steve when
right.
that was
yeah,
happening.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm curious, what's on people's minds? Like, you really probably have a really good sense of what is stressing people out,
yeah.
what really kind of needs fixing in the mm-hmm. American psyche and the American culture. What is it?
People are lonely. Mm-hmm. People are lonely and disconnected, and they've confused social media tools with connection tools, not communication tools. They think they can hack a way into connection that will not involve vulnerability. And it's people are lonely.
Yeah.
And you got to sit across from people and look them in the eye.
Find other humans.
That's it.
Dr. Brené Brown's Netflix special is called The Call to Courage. It is streaming now. Brené, I'm so glad I got to meet you. Thanks for coming
I'm
to all of it.
I'm such a fan girl. I was like, oh my God, that's her from MTV. I didn't know. I was like, oh my God.
We're going to do selfie during the music button.
For sure.
This is all of it on WNYC.